but not that hot. A car came so close to me that its side mirrors nearly swiped my handlebars. The edginess didn't go away. Not after I brought my bike inside my apartment, my legs so shaky I thought my knees were going to buckle. Not after I'd eaten what little dinner I could. Not as I lay in bed, inhaling shallow sips of breath. Not as thoughts bombarded me, particularly the fear that I was losing my mind. The rush of energy in my chest and pressure on my stomach stayed with me for days, becoming even more tormenting. All I wanted was for it to go away, which made it worse. It was like being rattled from the inside until I felt like I was splintering. The human tendency toward anxiety goes back thousands of years. In ancient Greece and Rome, Epicurean and Stoic philosophers offered tips on how to avoid it. Spoiler, stop worrying about the past and fearing the future. In 17th and 18th century medical textbooks, along with the first descriptions of panic attacks, it was listed as part of melancholia. The symptoms were severe: hallucinations, mania, and delirium. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, Kraepelin saw it not as a disorder, but a symptom of many disorders, including manic depression. To Freud, it was its own neurosis. Anxiety was classified and reclassified with each edition of the DSM. In the DSM-1, it was listed as the main characteristic of psychoneurotic disorders and was used almost synonymously with neurosis. The 1950s and 1960s are often referred to as the Age of Anxiety, to use W.H. Auden's phrase, but it wasn't the anxiety we know today. Its symptoms were more typical of depression: sadness, malaise, headaches, fatigue, loss of appetite. The DSM-3 moved away from promoting anxiety as a neurosis and broke it into 9 separate conditions, including phobias, panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. The DSM-4 added acute stress disorder as an anxiety subtype. The DSM-5 placed anxiety on a series of spectra with OCD and trauma and stressor-related disorders. It seemed so mild. Anxiety. Worry, nervousness, unease. But the mere presence of it has been shown to increase the chances of suicidal ideation and suicide. Anxiety makes a person feel besieged and threatened when there's no threat. Those rushes of energy I felt, the shakiness and edginess and splintering and catastrophic thoughts made me 10 times more likely to end up in the dark place I eventually did. I just needed to relax. In yoga classes, I stood at the top of my mat and ohmed and breathed and stretched and twisted the tension from my body, as the teacher said. Someone told me to rub the mastoid bone behind my ears, which I did every morning and every night. I bought Chinese herbs at a store in the East Village, the root of some plant I can't remember. It looked like blackened tree bark and smelled like a rotting dog. I know that smell. A stray dog died in the empty lot next to the apartment I shared with Chris in Chicago. It took us days to figure out what it was. I steeped the Chinese root in boiling water and gagged it down to no effect. I meditated. Oh, did I meditate? None of it helped. At my first annual checkup in 2 years, my health insurance coverage was spotty. I saw a new primary care physician. The waiting room of his office was small and painted a disquieting shade of Easter egg blue. The plan was never to tell him what I'd been experiencing, about how riding the subway made me feel like someone was drilling into my nervous system, or how insomnia had become an abiding part of my life. He was short and middle-aged, and brought to mind the word Clement. His expression was pleasant, his manner confident, giving the impression that none of his patients stayed sick for long. He had a paternal manner and seemed genuine. We went through the usual pokes and prods. He listened to my heart and lungs and then asked if I had any health concerns. It didn't seem worth it to tell him. What would I say? I feel edgy? I'm splintering? When the exam ended, he left the room and I dressed. He knocked and came back in to see if there was anything else I needed. I told him about the edginess, though not the splintering. This evoked an enthusiastic nod. Sure, he said, going to his prescription pad. After scribbling on it, he handed me a prescription for a medication I'd never heard of, diazepam. What's this? I asked. Valium, he said. I must have looked worried. It's like having a glass of scotch. With the prescription in my pocket, I stepped out onto 56th Street. It seemed harmless enough to fill it. I'd keep the Valium around, just in case. That night in my apartment, I stood in the kitchen. The translucent orange prescription bottle sat on the counter. On the radio, a reporter talked about the U.S. occupation in Iraq. Deciding I didn't need to take a pill, I went back to bed. I lay there for hours. The edginess grew into a tormenting low-level hum in my chest. I breathed in and out, in and out. The hum swelled. My mind started on repeat. I can't take this. I can't take this. I can't take this. This wasn't like the hypochondria. Hypochondria had staying power. It was a slow preoccupation. This was splintering from the inside out. I got out of bed and paced. My apartment looked out onto the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway. Cars zoomed by, too fast. The tormenting hum swelled again, breaking, flooding me with mute horror. Turning on the kitchen light, I filled a glass with water and fumbled with the Valium bottle. Finally negotiating the top off, I tipped the little blue pills into my hand. A whole or a half? Two? Then came the thought. You're just being dramatic. A phrase so often thrown at women. I was being hysterical. I didn't want to be hysterical. After funneling the pills back into the bottle, I twisted the cap closed. I hadn't been told my diagnosis, but I hadn't asked either. He may have assumed I was there for the Valium. The diagnosis was a formality. Valium was one of the first wonder drugs. There'd been others, Thorazine for psychosis, lithium for mania, and Elavil and Nardil for suicidal depression. But those were for the insane. Valium was mother's little helper, a happy pill for housewives. Miltown was the happy pill of the 1950s, and SSRIs for the 1980s and 1990s and 2000s and 2010s and... As a remedy for everyday stress, it changed psychopharmacology. Drug companies didn't need to develop medication for people with severe mental illnesses anymore. They could cater to those who wanted to feel normal and happy and had the means to pay for it. By the 1970s, it was the most frequently prescribed drug in the United States. Given the ubiquitous ask your doctor and talk to your doctor advertising campaigns, did it really come as a surprise that my doctor might have thought I just wanted a pill? The now seminal Ask Your Doctor marketing ploy started in 1976. The manufacturer of the then prescription drug Robitussin, A.H. Robbins Company, came up with the idea. A commercial told viewers, "The makers of Robitussin ask you to ask your doctor." They figured out that they didn't need to sell cough syrup. Consumers sold it to themselves, and their doctors endorsed it. Today, the U.S. is one of only three countries in the world that allows direct-to-consumer advertising for psychotropic medications. By 2016, pharmaceutical companies were spending nearly $6 billion on direct-to-consumer ads encouraging us to self-diagnose and self-medicate. What did I expect? Like most physicians, he was trained to identify and treat patients as efficiently as possible with the appropriate treatment, which usually meant a prescription medication. I didn't know it then, but I'd soon learn that talking to a doctor about a mental health condition is like going to a lemonade stand and saying you're thirsty. You're going to get lemonade. On one of my last days at the school, I saw Jackie in the hallway. She waved for me to wait. As we walked, I heard a clicking sound. At first, I thought it was her high heels ticking against the linoleum floor, but it was the Valium in the pillbox in my pocket. I hadn't taken one yet, but carried the pills around with me, five, just in case. She held open the door and said to let her know if I needed anything. The smell of bleach hit me as I entered the classroom. I said hello to Ms. Madeline and Sam and Maria and the students. Kamal greeted me with a, "You talking to me?" As I put down my bag and pulled out the handouts, the edginess turned to splintering. I stood at the front of the room. The edginess came first, then the splintering inside my mind. I didn't feel capable of reading a poem. It seemed impossible. I asked the students to imagine a machine that could produce love. Would it be pocket size? Would it be enormous? What would the love it makes look like? The room seemed to fall away for a moment. Draw a picture of the machine, I said. Shaky, I passed out markers and the handouts I'd brought. They started to draw. After circling the room, wishing the class would be over, I walked behind Noel. He'd drawn a television set with wings. It was so animated, so alive. He'd written something, too. I leaned in to read it. He cupped his hand over one ear, the other over his mouth. I should have stopped, backed away. Not thinking, I asked, "Can I see your paper?" and picked it up without waiting for him to respond. He gripped his ear more tightly. I realized what I'd done. "I'm sorry." I put the paper on his desk. His face reddened. "Here," I patted the paper. "It's right here." If I described what Noel did next, it would make him seem crazy. My rendering of how the other students responded would make it more so. M. Remy Yergo, an academic and author with autism, and others write that our typical autism essays and gimmicky fiction and irresponsible screenplays about autism silence neuroatypical people with autism who are better able to tell their own stories. My version of events wouldn't give his perspective. I'll say this much. Mr. Sam approached him. Eventually, he guided Noel out of the room. Eventually, Ms. Madeline clapped to call the students to attention. Eventually, the students clapped in response. Ms. Madeline suggested we wrap up for the day. I collected the students' papers and gathered my things. As I walked out of the room, the pills clicked in the pill box in my pocket. Later, I sat on a bench in Socrates Sculpture Park on the bank of the East River. It was once a landfill that artists and neighbors had turned into an outdoor art exhibition. All around were sculptures, the head of a yak carved out of stone, an inflatable Buddha floating in the river, Christo-esque drapes of blue fabric suspended above steel poles. I pulled Noel's drawing from my bag. On his paper, above the TV set with wings, he'd written, "Draw a picture of the machine." Why had I taken his paper the way I did? In its rhetorical form, the question mark is about self-inquiry. It's a way to resolve doubt, a way to cross-examine ourselves. A debate with the self questioning the self. In English, it appears at the end of a sentence. It requests and inquires. It's our most intimate form of punctuation. It's us at our most vulnerable. It's how we ask for help. When it serves as a comma and a list of questions, it signals persistence. Are you tired? Question mark. Hungry? Question mark. Angry? Question mark. Sad? Question mark. The desire to know. According to lore, the ancient Egyptians placed the symbol on maps to mark new and unknown locations. Why that particular shape? Why the lengthening curve? The symbol makes sense when you think of the ancient Egyptians' love of cats. When a beloved cat died, they shaved their eyebrows in honor of it. A question mark is the shape a cat makes with its tail when it's surprised or curious. The question mark may have started in Rome, arising out of the Latin word for question, questio. Questio was shortened to quo. Someone, somewhere, wrote the Q over the O, the Q lost its shape, the O collapsed into a dot, and the question mark was made. Others believe an 8th century scholar named Alcuin of York originated it. His punctus interrogativus told monks to raise their voices in question at the end of a clause. The shape first appeared in medieval texts as a dot and a tilde, or lightning strike, that may have evolved into the mark we know today. The question mark creates a relationship. We use it to ask of one another to get to know each other, or at least try. A wind swept over the river. The inflatable Buddha undulated on the waves. The doctor's voice sounded in my ears. It's like having a glass of scotch. I pulled out the pill box and popped it open. The pill felt light between my fingers. Chalky. Just chalk. It was insubstantial on my tongue. I sipped from my water bottle and swallowed. After too long, the edginess smoothed out. My mind dulled. A not unpleasant weakness took hold of the lower half of my body. What was the harm in that? 6. Cracked. The knife blade rested on the grapefruit's yellow skin. Paul stood behind me. He'd asked me a question. My hands shook as I guided the knife through the center of the grapefruit's pink flesh until it split open. "Out of the blue," Paul said, shaking his head in confusion. I'd asked him to move out of the apartment we'd shared for half a year without conflict, half a year during which he, an actor, who really was an actor, not trying to be one, had raised enough money to make the feature-length film he'd dreamed of, and I'd produced a poetry festival in Lower Manhattan. Years later, I'd see his character get stabbed on an episode of the hit TV series The Americans and feel unreasonably sad. Nothing romantic had sprouted between us. No rift had occurred. "I don't understand," he said. "I've met your mother." She'd come to visit a few times, and I'd performed well. I'd performed well the weekend my father visited, too. Telling them, or anyone, hadn't been an option. Not because I thought they wouldn't be supportive, but because I'd grown distant from them and myself. And I couldn't say, "Something's wrong, but I don't know what it is. I'm not." I traced the knife along each of the grapefruit segments. Its juice seeped onto my fingers. Even with the Valium, I wasn't sleeping much. I worked 3 jobs and completed the work due for my MFA program, all while feeling like my mind was in shards and my nerves were being pulled out of my skin. Paul stood behind me, waiting. Such an unreasonable urge to scream. He couldn't have understood that I needed to be alone. Not alone in the sense of the only one in the room, but alone as in no one and nothing anywhere ever. So I could stop from breaking or go ahead and shatter completely. "Well, if you're not going to say anything." He went to his room and closed the door behind him. The loft, my loft, was in an industrial building not zoned for residential use. It seemed, in my jagged, ramped-up state, reasonable to lease a loft illegally and build it out. I paid for it with the money I earned as a writing consultant in the public schools. I was still a writer in residence and had started teaching creative writing for a non-accredited continuing education program for adults. The consultancy paid more in a month than I made in a year. A recruiter had seen me teach a class of 4th graders, regular education, at a school in Queens, and the company hired me to mentor teachers and give workshops about how I taught writing, which fit the company's model. Paul was the first roommate applicant I'd met with. As soon as I met him, my decision to offer him the second room was made. It wasn't just that he was clean-cut and clearly could pay his rent. He was one of those people who wanted to make the world a better place. With sincerity, he spoke of the book he was reading about stopping world hunger or his passion for LGBTQ+ rights. He was kind and generous. There was no reason for the tension between us. No reason, except that I was cracking. I put the knife onto the counter. The Valium was in a pill box in my pocket. The pills didn't rattle, but their silence had become a kind of call. I couldn't take one yet. It wasn't time. I never took them in the morning before teaching. At the table, I sat. The need to scream started to fade. Shakily, I ate the grapefruit, licking the sweet, bitter juice from my fingers. The term nervous breakdown wouldn't have occurred to me then. That was something out of the 1950s, when businessmen had too many two martini lunches, and McLean Hospital was where poets like Sylvia Plath and Robert Lowell went to recover from artistic collapses. Use of the term is said to have peaked in the United States around 1940. The condition that had also been called a nervous disorder or nervous illness had been around for almost a century. Someone with a nervous disorder didn't exhibit psychosis, hearing voices, talking to people who weren't there, intense paranoia, speaking in word salad, where phrases and clauses jumble together nonsensically. A nervous disorder was characterized by exhaustion, mild depression, mild anxiety, bodily complaints, chronic pain, insomnia, irritable bowels, and obsessive thinking. It was separate from insanity and most often experienced by the worried well. In 1869, the neurologist George M. Beard referred to nervous exhaustion as neurasthenia, which he believed only the elite in society suffered from. It was all the rage among elites, artists, and leaders, as if they alone were prone to the stresses of contemporary life and the sweeping technological advances of the age, like the steam engine. Those afflicted included Henry and Alice James, Edith Wharton, Jack London, and Charlotte Perkins Gilman, whose short story, The Yellow Wallpaper, is a harrowing depiction of the rest cure that forced women to isolate in bed and do nothing, a treatment that, unsurprisingly, could lead to psychosis. My nervousness wasn't from stress, and I wasn't exhausted. My experience was closer to the 19th century German understanding of neurasthenia, an illness marked by a complete breakdown of the psyche. Later that morning in the South Bronx, I walked from the 6 train, passing bodegas and men on park benches, toward the school where I was teaching. The men stared at me, out of boredom or interest or both. Each step I took was accompanied not by anxiety, but fragility. Fragility fueled by the certainty that I was about to crack. If I could have a Valium, just a nibble. A nibble entailed gnawing off chalky bits of one of the blue pills. A nibble didn't count. I stopped outside the school entrance. In my bag was a bottle of water, and in my pocket, the pill box. It would be easy enough to... The doors to the school swung open, and a man, an administrator, came out. He nodded. I nodded back. Business as usual. In the foyer, I handed the security guard my bag. He gave it a cursory glance and gestured for me to pass through the metal detector. The bell signaling the change of classes rang. Students poured into the hallway. They shouted. No lockers opened and clanged shut. They weren't allowed to have them, something about them supposedly storing drugs. I passed a bulletin board half full of quizzes on display to commend students for getting 90s and 95s out of 100. The other half had been ripped off and lay on the floor. The clock on the wall was stopped at 8:42. When I reached the classroom, I peered in the small window in the door. The 8 male students were seated at small desks positioned far enough from each other so that no student could land a punch on another without getting up. Technically, they were in the 7th grade, but they read on a 4th grade level. A few of them, big and bulky, with the beginnings of manhood, looked much older than 12, and may have been 14 or older, and had been held back several grades. They barely fit in their desks. I'd taught students with their diagnosis before. Severe emotional disturbance, SED. One veteran teacher I'd worked with, Ms. Jackson, was fierce and brilliant. Her students had been labeled SED. She said that although they didn't behave, they weren't emotionally disturbed. They were angry. They're smart as hell and have never been taught to read or write. They've slipped through the system. Wouldn't you be angry? Students with SED were challenging. In a different classroom at another school, during a heated argument over a notebook, a student had yanked another student's hair so hard she pulled her to the floor. Once, a student threw a desk across the room. Twice, I'd been spit at. Classroom management, in many ways, was out of my control. I was just a visitor. The teacher set the tone. As I entered, the head teacher, who sat at her desk, looked up and clicked her chin as if checking me in. Then she went back to eating Oreos. The assistant teacher sat on the other side of the room at her desk eating Doritos. If she noticed me, she didn't show it. 2 students in the back row stared out the window. 2 in the middle row, leaning toward each other, low and obvious, passed something between them. 1 in the front row quietly stared down at a book, reading as if in a different classroom where learning actually took place. Darnell sat slumped in his chair with his arms crossed. On one of my first days, the teacher had complained to me, loud enough so the students could hear, that they could barely read a word. I'd found that 5 of them could read, albeit with difficulty. It had taken 7 of my 10 classes with them, but those 5 had eventually allowed me to see what they could do. Darnell hadn't given me the chance. He never looked me in the eye. Once, when I stood at the front of the room trying to teach, he muttered, loud enough for me to hear, "White bitch." With the other students, he was wry and funny with a charm that bordered on charisma. As I passed the first row of desks, Darnell slumped lower in his seat, muttering a loose, "Shit." The teacher called me over. She leaned forward as if to whisper something to me. Then, loud enough for everyone to hear, she said, "Darnell has a problem." Darnell grimaced and looked away. "We had a visit from a nice man from the zoo. He brought reptiles for the children to learn about." She addressed Darnell. "You want to tell her what you did?" Darnell clearly didn't. My participation in this public reprimand wasn't going to strengthen our relationship. I went toward the board to start the lesson. "Darnell," the head teacher went on, "grabbed one of the frogs, took it by the mouth, and tried to rip it in half." I kept writing on the board. "In half," she repeated, "which is why he'll be leaving us soon for his VIP appointment with the vice principal." Darnell continued to look away. There was a flush to his cheeks. I couldn't tell if it was embarrassment or anger or both. There came a knock on the door. A man poked his head in and called Darnell's name. Darnell rolled his eyes and slunk out of his chair. He walked so slowly that the man had already stepped into the hall and the door had closed. I expected Darnell to open and slam the door shut, but he didn't. He just let it close behind him. I handed out 6 different translations of Basho's haiku. "The old pond. A frog jumps in. Plop." I told them that each of them would read it in his own way. They were decidedly unimpressed. I'd taught them Shakespeare, Langston Hughes, Etheridge Knight, and Sylvia Plath, and none had moved them to anything beyond groaning participation. During the mini-lesson on imagery and haiku, I entered what I called the teaching zone, snatches of time when I wasn't splintering or I wasn't thinking about Valium. My mind was centered. My body felt strong. Barely managing to keep their attention, I went over how a haiku was 3 lines and followed the syllabic count of 5-7-5. Japanese doesn't translate syllabically into English that way, but the syllables make it easier to teach. I assigned them to write their own. They twisted in their desks as if being physically tortured. When I reminded them that they only had to write 3 lines, they perked up. One jibed the student next to him, "You can't even write 1 line." Soon they were all ribbing each other until they were competing to show who had written the most lines. The majority of them had been subclassified with oppositional defiant disorder. At the time, confidentiality either wasn't followed or didn't exist because I shouldn't have known their diagnoses. ODD first appeared in the DSM-3 as oppositional disorder, which said that a child between the ages of 3 and 17 who exhibits 2 or more of the following over 6 months was pathologically antisocial. 1, throws temper tantrums. 2, violates minor rules. 3, argues. 4, displays provocative behavior. Or 5, is stubborn. Don't most children, and many adults, throw temper tantrums? What child doesn't violate minor rules? Isn't stubbornness a requirement of anyone under the age of 30? The DSM-3R attempted, in its own feeble way, to limit the number of children diagnosed with ODD by adding the word often. Often throws temper tantrums, often violates minor rules, etc. But often was such a vague measure as to be useless. The DSM-3 also added more symptoms, bringing the total to 9, including often swears and deliberately annoys people. It also eliminated the safeguard that the child had to be older than 3 to be diagnosed. Terrible twos, anyone? The DSM-4 did little to help. It lowered the number of symptoms to 8, removing swearing but leaving in argues and deliberately annoys people, and reinstated the minimum age of 3. Again, it emphasized clinical significance. As with adults, clinical significance doesn't determine if a child's behavior and thinking are extreme enough to be pathologized. It sounds scientific, definite, but in practice means little. Darnell's actions and mental state were clinically significant if he demonstrated 1, just 1 of the following: an inability to learn not explained by other factors, difficulty maintaining relationships, or inappropriate behavior, moodiness, or fears associated with school or personal problems. The DSM-5 hadn't yet been published, but it wouldn't have helped Darnell escape a diagnosis either. It left the ODD diagnosis basically unchanged and introduced the highly controversial disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, the crossover symptoms of which, irritability and temper tantrums, made it possible to diagnose more children with both disorders. The ODD diagnosis invites so many sexist and racist assumptions and implicit biases as to border on unethical. ODD primarily stigmatizes children of color. A 2010 study states, openly and in writing, that disruptive behavior disorders like ODD are predictive of later criminal charges. Couple that stigma with a study that showed that clinicians are more likely to diagnose young people of color with ODD. Add to that the multiple studies that demonstrate how children of color receive stigmatizing diagnoses like ODD, whereas white children are given a relatively less stigmatizing diagnosis like ADHD. Had Darnell been white, he may not have received a diagnosis at all. In one review, researchers found that the behavior and emotional states of young people of color are pathologized with what are widely considered to be more serious mental illnesses. Having received a diagnosis like ODD and entering the mental health system, Darnell would likely remain in it, encountering racism well into adulthood. Studies have shown that physicians' implicit biases are major factors in determining a diagnosis. Latinos are 3 times more likely to be diagnosed with psychotic illnesses than whites are. Blacks are nearly twice as likely as whites to be told they have schizophrenia. Native and Alaskan Native patients have the highest rate of psychiatric diagnosis and are most likely to report mental distress, yet whites receive the most services. This disparity has been found in marginalized communities overall. Rates of diagnosis according to race and ethnicity are controversial. Some say people from racial and ethnic minority groups don't have an increased risk for psychiatric disorder, but that mental illnesses in marginalized groups are more persistent. The persistence of mental illness could be the result of barriers to care and systemic racism, lack of insurance and access to providers, cultural and racial insensitivity, and the unavailability of economic means to pay for care. Most researchers agree disadvantaged racial and ethnic minority groups are less likely to have access to and receive treatment. And others argue it's because Blacks, Native peoples, and Latinos tend not to report to mental health care providers due to stigma, religious beliefs, lack of diversity among providers, language barriers, distrust in the healthcare system, or lack of insurance. The ODD diagnosis begs many questions. How often are Black boys deemed aggressive? How much more frequently are Black girls perceived as resentful? Aren't the rules associated with behaviors like tantrums and emotions like anger and argumentativeness determined by the dominant white culture's norms? Who decides if Darnell's stubbornness is clinically significant? A white school counselor or therapist? Unlike Darnell, I wasn't a child caught in a system loaded against me. I had the privilege to ignore whatever diagnosis the doctor had given me so I could fill my prescription of Valium and take the little blue pills now and again. And again. And again. On my way home on the 6 train, I sat in the nearly empty subway car and tried to read Emily Dickinson, whose poetry I loved and didn't understand. Her use of dashes, not the crosses and other calligraphic oddities, drew me in. I heard a fly buzz, dash, when I died, dash. Though critics made much of how she used them, for emphasis, to introduce a list, to interrupt, and as parentheses, no one knows what she meant in every instance. To me, they function as place markers, a way to guide the reader beyond normal punctuation. They also usher the reader through, inviting us to keep reading. I fingered the pillbox in my pocket. At 86th Street, people piled on. I gave up my seat in case someone needed it more than I did. A white man in a business suit took it. Oblivious to the pregnant woman next to him, he sat and stared down at his magazine. At Lexington, more people got on, forcing me to the back of the train. A woman pressed against me. The Grand Central stop brought more people. As they squeezed in on me, I tensed as the cracking feeling took hold. A pill. Just one. I pulled out my pill box, elbowing the woman behind me as I did. I unzipped my bag and grabbed my water bottle. It was empty. I hadn't filled it before leaving the school. Nimbly, I popped open the pillbox with one hand, raised it to my lips, tongued a pill, and swallowed it dry. When I got home, soupy from the Valium, Paul was out. On the kitchen counter, he'd left a note saying he wanted to talk. I didn't want to talk. I wanted another Valium. The next afternoon, I went to a professional development meeting for my consultant job. Inside a small auditorium in an elementary school on the Lower East Side, I sat with the other consultants and listened to my Australian supervisor talk about accountability frameworks and a balanced literacy approach. The cracked feeling returned. You have to get out of here or take a Valium. Just one. A nibble. If I hadn't had to teach a creative writing class that evening, I would have. That night, I sat at the head of a circle of desks in a classroom in a West Village elementary school rented out by the continuing education company I worked for. Around and across from me sat my four students, an MBA grad, a stay-at-home mom, a librarian, and a waitress, all of whom wanted to learn to write fiction. The librarian loved romance novels and hoped to publish one someday. The MBA student read John le Carré and imagined a series of his own. The waitress read and wrote raunchy experimental fiction that made me feel like a Puritan. The stay-at-home mom wasn't sure what she wanted to write. We were studying characterization in a short story by Jhumpa Lahiri. I brought up punctuation, not in the story, but in general. I asked if they ever thought about how expressive parenthetical marks could be. Commas, I said, are like two speed bumps that barely slow the reader down. Parentheses, almost always, force the reader to step inside. Dashes, always, elide and invite the reader in. Two of my students seemed to brace themselves. Another looked away. It had been the same in my MFA program. Punctuation and grammar barely got a mention, as if writing had nothing to do with them. Never mind that my fellow MFA students, like these uncomfortable students before me, didn't know how to use commas or dashes or parentheses, let alone any of the more sophisticated punctuation marks like the semicolon with any kind of style. Punctuation supposedly made students nervous and hampered their creativity. I never understood how aspiring writers could expect to feel at ease and inspired while writing if they didn't know how to punctuate sentences. At the end of class, my students stood, smiling and talking of the characterization assignment I'd given them. I wished them good night. As I put on my coat, the pills rattled in my pocket. I'd forgotten about them. Maybe I didn't need them after all. I practically strode down 6th Avenue, but by the time I reached 12th and 2nd, the fragile feeling crept in. It was too much. Too much noise, too many people, too many cars. Too many lights. At the sound of a car honking behind me, I turned. My neck cracked. I pulled my water bottle from my bag and took two Valium. Later, I learned that Valium's risk for addiction is extremely high. The more I took it, the harder it was for my brain to function without it. Valium has a longer half-life than other benzodiazepines like Xanax, Clonopin, and Ativan. The onset of action is rapid. It peaks after an hour, and then lingers for up to 2 days. Dependence is quick. Withdrawal produces the same symptoms it's prescribed to treat: anxiety, insomnia, panic attacks, and worse, psychosis, seizures, suicide. Valium activates dopamine in the brain, which may help in the short term. It also hijacks the reward system, causing it to malfunction. The need for more increases. Memory and learning are affected. I could fault my doctor and the pharmaceutical drug industry for putting me at risk, but I couldn't have held those little blue pills in my hand without a diagnostic code. My primary care physician might have written 300.02 for generalized anxiety disorder on my chart. Having a diagnostic code made it possible for me to pick up my Schedule 4 narcotic from the pharmacy and for him to be reimbursed by my insurance company for my visit. If I'd known he'd labeled me 300.02 and that meant generalized anxiety disorder, I might have believed him. My mother always said I had a singular way of worrying about the world. On a routine visit to the doctor, I supposedly sat on the examination table while we waited and pointed to the band-aids and gauze and sharp instruments on the counter and asked, "What are they going to do to me that I'm going to need those?" Originally, diagnostic codes were supposed to aid in compiling statistical data and hospital admittances, but their main function has become helping doctors get paid and patients receive treatment. The Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act says mental health benefits should be equal to other medical benefits, but an insurance company will only cover medical necessity. That gets tricky when it comes to DSM diagnoses. Is treatment for what are considered more minor diagnoses, like anxiety, medically necessary? Psychiatrists, psychologists, and others use workarounds, labeling patients with false, more severe diagnoses to make sure that insurance companies will cover treatment. A doctor who levels a diagnosis may not actually believe the patient even has it. Sometimes the patient is in on it, agreeing to accept a more severe diagnosis in return for medical coverage. Even if the patient doesn't actually believe the diagnosis, it's on the patient's record, and in a sense, it becomes real. Even without knowing my diagnosis, my prescription marked me. If I'd seen a psychiatrist and told him I was taking Valium and it had helped, which it had in a dark, dislocating, soupy way, that doctor likely would have seen my prescription as confirmation of a diagnosis. A code like 300.02 was on my medical record. I had a diagnosis, whether I knew it or not. The following week, my last day at the school, Darnell wasn't in class. The teacher told me he'd been expelled for the incident with the frog. "Rightly so," she said loud enough for the students to hear. On the board, I wrote a summary of the day's lesson. The students sat listlessly. Darnell's desk sat empty. After school, on my way to the train, I thought of how I'd never see the boys in that class again. What would happen to them after having been pathologized as pre-criminal and emotionally disturbed and disruptive at such a young age? I got home to the loft to find Paul's stuff gone. All of it. He'd moved out that day. Gone was most of the furniture, which had been his. Without a couch or a coffee table or even a light, the loft was dark and bare. Rain collected in a puddle on the floor. Either he or I had left the window open. Most likely, definitely, it had been me. No one knows the true origins of the dash. Some credit the 12th century Italian scholar Boncompagno da Signa, who developed his own system of marking punctuation in a text. He used a vertical slash to signal a pause and a horizontal one to indicate a full stop. By the 18th century, novelists like Samuel Richardson and Lawrence Stern were using it to isolate phrases of unnecessary information or parenthetical asides. The pills were there, weren't they always? And they'd become necessary. In the 19th century, Charlotte Bronte used them to indicate interrupted speech. She and other authors also used it in aposiopesis, where a sentence is broken off and left unfinished. "I said the pills were dash." The M dash, so named because it's about the length of an M, primarily connects or interrupts phrases and clauses. An N dash, which is about the length of the N, is for numbers, dates, and time. 2000 to 2007. The short hyphen connects words and prefixes. Anti-anxiety medication. Too often, the M dash can be a way to cut off, to end. It can also elide. In the U.S. mental health system, people of color are disregarded. Drug research focuses on white men. In some trials, whites make up as much as 90% of subjects. The 1993 National Institutes of Health Revitalization Act required drug companies to include people of color, but a 2014 study found that fewer than 2% of more than 10,000 cancer clinical trials focused on a racial or ethnic minority. People of color and children of color, like Darnell, exist between dashes. After Paul moved out, the loft felt damp, as if the rain I'd sopped up had stayed. Maybe it was the soupiness of the Valium. The loft felt empty, too, probably because it was. When I spoke on the phone with my mother or my father, which was rare because I'd isolated myself from them and everyone else, my voice echoed in the unfurnished emptiness of Paul's absence. I'd closed the door to his vacant room, but it hadn't helped. The night I decided to stop taking Valium, I was in the bath. The water was warm, the apartment air very cold. I lifted my hand from the water. Steam rose off it. As the water dripped, I realized that maybe it wasn't normal to keep the thermostat off, even though it was freezing. My soupy mind had been saying not to bother. I stopped taking the little blue pills. Just like that. No doctor supervision, which I later learned was dangerous and could have led to seizures or worse. No Narcotics Anonymous. Insomnia tormented me. Intense stomach cramps sometimes made me double over. My migraines were blinding. The cracking feeling intensified. I walked the streets to try to lessen it. When it was too cold or rainy, I paced my loft in the near dark. Out my window, I could make out the Williamsburg Bridge and Lower Manhattan. From ground zero, two spotlights beamed into the night sky in memory of those who died on 9/11. In the building next door, a television set flickered blue, faded, and flickered blue again. One night, I walked the Manhattan streets until after midnight, down one block and the next. I let the stoplights tell me which way to go. At a walk sign, I'd cross. Don't walk meant turn the corner. I repeated the few lines of a Dickinson poem I could still recall. I cannot live with you, dash. It would be life, dash. And life is over there, dash. Behind the shelf, dash. I reached Astor Place, where a man and woman were spinning the cube. I turned around and headed back uptown, through Union Square to the New York Public Library. The lions on either side of the library glowed in the spotlights. The scene made me think of old New York and the Great Gatsby and Fitzgerald's essay, The Crack-Up. In The Crack-Up, he talks about breaking down and becoming little more than a cracked plate. His situation was nothing like mine, and I felt nothing like a plate, but the cracking was the same. The essay had one of my favorite lines in it, which I never got quite right. The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. I stared at the lion's stone faces. To me, it seemed unlikely that Darnell had intended to kill the frog. It also didn't seem plausible that he tried to rip it in half to get attention, as the teacher had said. It had to be more complicated than that. Maybe a storm of anger had come over him and the frog was part of that storm. Maybe he hadn't considered that what he was doing might inflict pain. Maybe he wanted... I had no idea what Darnell wanted, as a white, privileged woman with Valium in her pocket. I didn't pretend I could. A notice arrived from my landlord. The building had been sold. Because it wasn't zoned for residential, I was technically a squatter who happened to have spent thousands building out her loft. They gave me a month to move out. I started to cry, then sob. In the kitchen, I took the pillbox from where I'd stashed it in the cupboards behind the herbal tea. Three little blue pills left. I fumbled to get the pillbox open. Then I put it on the counter and called my mother. All I could muster were scattered words.
I,
my mother said, try to calm down.
I just,
take a breath, she said.
I,
take a breath. I kept stuttering, my words broken off by dashes. Weeks later, she came to New York to help me pack. It was clear, even to me, that living in the city wasn't working anymore. When I opened my apartment door to greet her, she didn't say anything. I must have looked as shattered as I felt. She tried to cover her reaction with a hug. We sat on the floor wrapping dishes in newspaper and talked about what would happen next. I didn't tell her about the Valium. I said I just wanted to take a break from New York, put my belongings in storage, stay with her in Chicago for a while, and then come back. She wrapped a knife in newspaper and nodded unconvincingly.
I mean, I have to come back. I need to...
We'll see how it goes, she said. 7. Doctor's orders. At my mother's, I did the dishes and vacuumed and dusted and cooked to try to make up for worrying her. She said she was happy to have me there. It seemed hard to believe. We didn't call it a nervous breakdown or depression. We didn't call it anything. My father, stepmother, sister, and brother-in-law weren't aware of what was happening. My niece and nephew were too young to wonder why Aunt Sarah lived with Nana while other adults had their own houses and families. I didn't tell my mother how much pain I was in. In what had once been her study and was now a makeshift room for me, I cried, quietly, so she wouldn't hear. It was as if leaving New York had flipped a switch on my tear ducts. To try to crawl out of the spiral I'd fallen into, I walked the same route day after day. I did 1,000 downward dogs. I taught creative writing online, which, except for my mother, was the extent of my social life. That year and a half is a series of snapshots. Me at the desk in my room, writing articles and essays about literature. Thick, insomniac nights staring out the window at the lights in the apartment building across the street. Me deplaning in Madrid to interview the novelist Javier Marías for the Paris Review, and then in Tokyo to interview Nobel laureate Kenzaburo Oe. My byline in the New York Times and then the Atlantic. Applications to graduate school. My acceptance letter to the doctoral program in English Literary Studies at the University of Iowa. The need to leave my mother's came on fast. Part of me must have thought that if I stayed with my mother too long, it would mean I had officially cracked. Surely 6 years in a PhD program would pull me out of it. Iowa City seemed perfect. Named the UNESCO City of Literature, it was the bastion of reading and writing I'd thought I'd find in Seattle. It was also a cheap place to live, which made it seem like buying a house was a good idea. I cashed in my IRA and all my savings and took the money my mother and father and stepmother generously gave me to buy it. It turned out that my meager teaching assistantship barely covered my mortgage payments and living expenses. But being in the program was like being on an idyllic, inconsequential planet made of books. It made me feel removed and sheltered. My department spoke a different language, dialectical materialism, the Lacanian symbolic, langue and parole, double consciousness, Foucauldian semiotics, heteroglossia. I was exempt from real life and spent my time happily alone researching in the stacks, in a real library, with actual books, or reading in a cafe or writing papers at home. Occasionally, I attended a reading or a department party, which made my social life seem vibrant. It was a life of the mind. I was quiet and calm. The edginess, the splintering, the cracking was gone. I was solid, whole, feet on the ground, no longer in a spiral. At least that's how it seemed. One afternoon, at the end of my fourth semester in the program, the students in my interpretation of literature course sat in their desk chairs arranged in a semicircle facing the board. The course was a general education requirement few would have opted to take. We'd finished Wuthering Heights, and they'd submitted their final essays, so I did a creative assignment with them. I wrote on the board, "Free write about uncertainty." They weren't creative writers. Most were business majors or pre-med, and looked at me as if to say, "Really?" I smiled. They humored me. They always humored me, mainly because I'd promised the course wouldn't be a waste of their time and had made good on it. They wanted practical skills. I respected that. Almost all of them, at least the ones who'd done the assignments, said they were leaving my class more confident in their writing, which I told them would make their lives exponentially easier. They pulled out their spiral notebooks and pens or opened their laptops. 10 minutes, I said, looking at the clock. Go. After class, I went to my office and sat at my desk to grade their final essays. My rubric tested them on one punctuation mark only, the comma. I'd learned that 6 of the 10 most frequent writing errors people made involved commas. If I taught the students to use commas correctly, they'd be that person in their workplace. The good writer. I gave presentations on comma rules, quizzed them, went over the rules again, quizzed them again. Some were curious from the beginning. They'd never been taught grammar or punctuation. Some wanted to keep it that way. I pulled out the stack of final essays. The first was written by one of the few students who hadn't paid attention, barely came to class, and had failed all the quizzes. I scanned it. Commas like he was decorating a Christmas tree. I thought of Mr. Baker and my 10th grade term paper. With my blue pen, most students had been scarred by years of red ink telling them how wrong they were, I circled the first error. When I finished grading, I went home and slumped my bag, heavy with the latest stack of library books, onto the coffee table. I made myself dinner and sat at my dining room table. The food on my plate was monochromatic. Orange. Different shades, but still orange. Carrots, sweet potatoes, butternut squash. One color. That was the rule. Many rules had come and gone. I'd eliminated and re-included foods, ordering and reordering what could be eaten and what must be avoided. Each change seemed vital. Meat was off-limits, no matter how grass-fed. Then it wasn't. Fish was permitted, but only farm-raised. Then only wild-caught. My nightshade intolerance was confirmed. Then it was questionable. Then I lit on color. Only green foods. Then only yellow. Then only purple and blue. Then only red and white. The thoughts were intense, particularly if I'd eaten the wrong color. Beets and purple cabbage instead of kale and zucchini. My mind looped again. Purple. No, green. Orange. Green. Definitely green. Distress. Disorder. Dysfunction. Disability. Distress is the result of external or internal pressure, e.g., a tornado, worry. It's a kind of torture. The distressed person feels both constrained and compelled to act. My eating habits were odd, but not distressing. The primary definition of disorder is confusion. One could have argued my food choices were odd. Eating by color, the Roy G. Biv diet, wasn't yet a thing, but within the decade would appear in Food and Wine and on the Food Network. But I wasn't confused. Psychiatry has never been able to define what makes thoughts, emotions, and behaviors dysfunctional. The DSM doesn't offer the equivalent of, for instance, systolic blood pressure numbers to determine if you have stage 1 hypertension or are in a hypertensive crisis. I may have deviated from the norm, but I was functioning well enough. I ate, I taught, I did my coursework and passed my exams. I'd traveled to San Francisco to interview the poet Kay Ryan for the Paris Review, and later interviewed the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Marilyn Robinson. Clearly, I didn't have a disability. Or did I? Were my movements, senses, or activities limited by how I was thinking? In comparison to whom? At what point does a person say, I'm distressed, disordered, dysfunctional, disabled? How do we judge if the person is right? My therapist, Anne, had a deep voice and chin-length hair and always wore jeans. In her office, she sat facing me on one couch. I sat on the other. My grad student health insurance was good to the point of indulgence, and almost everyone in my program saw a therapist, so I did too. Anne's curtness appealed to me. During most of our sessions, I complained about my problems, the pressure I felt about my upcoming exam, difficulties choosing my dissertation committee, uncertainties over a grading decision with a student. To most of what I said, she basically told me to get over it. Usually, she was right. She knew about the anorexia and my drinking and New York and living with my mother, but not the suicidal images and thoughts. She never asked about diagnoses or medications. I'd never told her about my monochromatic eating. That day, for some reason, I did. She asked me how I was doing. Offhandedly, I mentioned my one-color-only diet. She asked how much time I spent worrying about it. I asked if that included the hours spent at the co-op shopping for food. I knew almost all the employees by name, and writing up meal plans and cooking said meal plans and checking and rechecking. She said yes. I told her. She said, "You might have OCD." In obsessive-compulsive disorder, the obsession is invasive and relentless. It's uncontrollable and guilt-provoking. The obsessive thoughts are often of doing harmful or repugnant acts. Commonly, they stem from a need for order, symmetry, reassurance, or purity. The obsession is resisted, which is where the compulsion comes in. We often associate OCD with someone who washes her hands. The obsessive thought of contamination arrives, and the compulsive action of hand-washing alleviates her distress. When the thoughts return, the compulsion has to be enacted again and again, even though the skin on her hands is splitting open and may be infected from the incessant hand washing. OCD, in its current form, first appeared in the DSM-3 and has changed little. It was categorized under anxiety disorders until the DSM-5, when it was filed under obsessive-compulsive and related disorders. To be diagnosed, I only needed to display an obsession or a compulsion that caused marked distress, interfered with my normal routine, or took up more than an hour a day. The research disagrees that the two are mutually exclusive. Half of all OCD cases given by primary care physicians are misdiagnoses. OCD is stigmatizing and disabling. Sufferers aren't laughed with, they're laughed at. Oh, that's just my OCD acting up. The disorder interrupts their lives, straining relationships, and sometimes, though rarely, leading to suicide. In DSM terms, it was possible I had it. Recurrent or persistent ideas, thoughts, images, or feelings, check. The compulsion to act on them, check. Psychic discomfort and extreme doubt, which might look like a nervous person, check. I'd already had a classic OCD subtype, body dysmorphic disorder. I took a Do I Have OCD quiz online. Did I excessively count and arrange? Anne seemed to think so. Examine my body for signs of illness? Check. Unnecessarily reread or rewrite? It was my job. Avoid colors associated with unpleasant things? Absolutely. After just 20 questions, I scored a 15. OCD is likely. I called the specialist Anne recommended to make an appointment. The soonest was 2 months away.